produced and distributed by the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws in Washington, D.C. This is your normal daily audio stash. The growing truth about cannabis. Welcome to the most popular podcast regarding marijuana in all of America and all the world. Featuring interviews with scientists, politicians, doctors, prohibition policy activists, regular cannabis consumers, musicians, artists, and normal staff and Normal's board of directors, along with music and comedy no other podcast can offer. You can always find out more about the show at our website, stash.normal.org, and continue the education and conversation on our blog as well. We're ending marijuana prohibition with education, one listener at a time. The podcasting and blogging technology for the Normal Daily Audio Stash is provided by Red Aphid Interactive Media. Visit www.redaphid.com. It's Monday, May 19th, and it's 4:20 somewhere in the world. I'm your host, Radical Russ Belville. Don't forget to call your Congress at 202-224-3121 and tell your representative to support Barney Frank's H.R. 5843 bill that would legalize marijuana for personal use. Ending prohibition starts with you. For our political activism day today, I've just got to tell you about my Sunday at the waterfront in Portland, where me and 75,000 of my friends gathered to hear Senator Barack Obama. Check out the pictures, map, and video on my personal blog at RadicalRuss.com. It's exhilarating to feel so many people gathered for political change and awareness, and it's my goal to bring that wave of change toward ending adult marijuana prohibition. It's time for a change, and it starts with you. Today we start our political activism day halfway around the world to New Zealand, where we spoke with New Zealand Normal's Chris Fowley about their Global Marijuana March, or as they call it, J-Day. For our musical break on Blues Monday, we've got Julian Fouth, a contemporary blues man from Toronto, Canada. Cannabis Carrie picked out Roll On In. Is it a tribute to great joint rollers? Stay tuned and find out. And if it is, it ain't about me, because I'm a lousy joint roller. To conclude our stash, we welcome back New Normal Dad, Deputy Director Paul Armentano. Our international flavor continues as Paul breaks down research from Israel comparing the driving effects of mild doses of cannabis versus alcohol on drivers. We've also got another great Normal Pass the Stash contest. This time you could win the uncensored DVD of Totally Baked, written by Craig Shoemaker, a guest on the Stash. Bonus for you stashers, it's autographed by the executive producer, Brian Johnson, the lead singer of AC/DC. No joke, there are even three brand new Brian Johnson songs on the DVD. Listen for details later in the podcast on how you can win. And remember, if you're a business or nonprofit who'd like your message heard on the Daily Audio Stash or the Normal Weekly News, you can advertise with us. We have rates for every budget and a 10% discount for nonprofits. Just send us an email at stash@normal.org and we'll have you on the air in no time. So sit back and relax with a good friend and your favorite strain. It's time for your Normal Daily Audio Stash. Now it's time to take a look at the latest stories about marijuana from news organizations across America and around the world in our Normal Daily Audio Stash, Hemp Headlines. Okay, Stashers, part of our political activism day here on Monday is our roundup of all the legislative activities happening for this week. So check out the blog at normal.org. You can get the details on all of these. In Rhode Island, the Senate approved Senate Bill 2693, and so that's got to go through the House now and then up to the governor's desk. Check out the blog at blog.normal.org for all the links and how you can get involved. In California, we've got a victory on Assembly Bill 2279 coming out of a committee with a 6-2 vote. This is the bill that would protect patients from employment discrimination on the basis of being medical marijuana patients. Also in California, in Mendocino County, there is a decision on whether or not to repeal the county law known as Measure G. This is called Measure B, and as Dale Gehringer reminds us, Measure G is for good, Measure B is for bad. And the Measure B would overturn that measure to allow people 25 marijuana plants for personal possession and use. Visit California Normal at canormal.org, and you can learn more about both of those bills, or again, the blog at blog.normal.org. In Illinois, Senate Bill 2865 is a medical marijuana bill awaiting action by the full Senate. Recently was amended, and we talked about that here on the Daily Audio Stash. Check out Illinois Normal at illinoisnormal.org, the whole state spelled out, illinoisnormal.org, and you can get more information on that. And finally, in Minnesota, medical cannabis legislation is anticipated to go before the full House for a floor vote pretty soon, could be this week. Passage of this legislation would ensure that medical marijuana patients in Minnesota would no longer have to fear arrest or prosecution. However, Governor Pollent, he's indicated he's going to veto that bill if it gets to his desk. Get into our Normal online advocacy system at normal.org. You can join the petition to urge Pollent to rethink his position and also lobby these legislators and perhaps get a veto-proof majority. That's our Normal weekly legislative roundup for today, Monday, May 19th. Medical marijuana and organ transplants don't mix. From the Los Angeles Times. Seattle, Washington. This month, Timothy Guerin, age 56, a Seattle musician, died after being turned down for a liver transplant. He was rejected partly because he had used medical marijuana. Now, a second critically ill patient in Washington State says he has been denied a spot on two organ transplant programs because he uses doctor-prescribed marijuana. Jonathan Simchin, age 33, of Fife, a town south of Seattle, is a diabetic whose kidneys and pancreas have failed. He said he was removed from the transplant program at Virginia Mason Hospital in Seattle because he admitted using medical marijuana. Later, he said, University of Washington Medical Center transplant officials refused to accept him because of the medical marijuana issue. The lawyer who represented Guerin has taken on Simpson's case. Douglas Hyatt argues that his clients are the victims of a loosely defined transplant policy, one not based on science. University of Washington officials, citing privacy laws, declined to discuss specifics of individual cases, but issued a statement acknowledging that they took marijuana use into consideration. The statement said, quote, "Although medical marijuana may be an issue in rare cases, it is never the sole determinant in arriving at medical decisions about candidates for organ transplants," end quote. A spokeswoman for Virginia Mason Hospital said smoking of any kind could, quote, "lead to patient safety and transplant effectiveness issues," end quote, and was precluded. She said the hospital's transplant committee would also weigh a patient's use of medical marijuana in pill form. At the University of Washington, the transplant committee said it reviewed, quote, "behavioral concerns such as a history of substance abuse or dependency. If such a history exists, then the committee looks at the period of abstinence the candidate has demonstrated to date," end quote, as well as the patient's efforts to maintain abstinence and potential to abuse again. Asked why the committee considered marijuana use under a doctor's supervision a history of substance abuse, a hospital spokesman cited the federal law categorizing marijuana as an illegal drug. Peggy Stewart, a clinical social worker with the liver transplant program at the UCLA Medical Center, said bias existed in the medical community against marijuana because of the federal law. Some transplant committee members see it as an illegal substance and as grounds for automatic rejection. She said many other addictive prescriptions, particularly pain medications, did not automatically disqualify patients from transplant lists because they were not illegal substances under federal law. It's bad because it's illegal because it's bad.
Because it's illegal because it's bad. Because it's illegal because it's bad. Because it's illegal because it's bad. Because it's illegal because it's bad.
It is simply beyond my ability to process the outrage of this ignorant cowardice. Medical professionals will knowingly divert the frailest patients from the safe, non-toxic herb and onto the dangerous, addictive pharmaceuticals and then hide behind the government's skirts? Oh, it's against federal law. Your state doesn't think so. Members of your profession are recommending it, and your oath is to first do no harm. Furthermore, that one official that says they'd even weigh use of medical marijuana in pill form? That's called Marinol, and it isn't against federal law. As for the, quote, patient safety and transplant effectiveness issues, you don't have any evidence to back that up. Vaporization or edibles eliminate the problems with smoking. Post-transplant, there is no addictiveness in the serious physical sense of the word to jeopardize transplant effectiveness. This is nothing more than institutionalized discrimination against a disliked minority, only this isn't about the color of their skin, but rather the color of their medicine. Oregon judge rules medical marijuana doesn't cancel handgun rights. Now, this report is just in from Normal Legal Committee member Lee Berger, a criminal defense attorney here in Oregon. Washington County, in Hillsborough, just west of Portland, Oregon Judge Stephen L. Price ordered Sheriff Rob Gordon to return to three Oregon medical marijuana patients their concealed handgun licenses. Sheriff Gordon had denied one patient's application, one patient's renewal, and had revoked one patient's license based on the argument that federal law prohibiting the possession of a firearm by a controlled substance user preempted state law. Judge Price ruled it did not, as did Washington County Judge Marco Hernandez before him. Now, Lee Berger argued the same issue, basically with the same letter from the sheriff and the same argument from county council, before Jackson County presiding Judge Shively on Friday morning, and we're hopeful for a similar result. Now, I've always argued that the war on certain American citizens using non-pharmaceutical, non-alcoholic, tobacco-free drugs has on our constitutional rights, and the Second Amendment is no less a victim than the First, Fourth, Fifth, Sixth, Seventh, Eighth, Ninth, Tenth, 14th, and 15th. My contention is that since most mandatory minimum sentences double when there are firearms present, even if the firearms are legally possessed, doesn't this in essence serve to deprive cannabis consumers of our Second Amendment rights? People think of guns and drugs and automatically assume the person must be some cold-blooded drug dealer, when many are just cannabis gardeners who can't call the cops when scary kids with weapons break in to steal very profitable crops. But these cases take the cake. I've talked with Lee about these cases where sheriffs in Oregon's more conservative counties will disarm medical marijuana patients who are following state laws, both with respect to marijuana and the handgun. The idea that the patients are really just dope dealers is a prejudice found often in law enforcement, which is the craziest idea when those patients have filled out a form with the state and registered their address for growing into an electronic database that is instantly accessible by law enforcement to verify legality. That's far more registration than most law-abiding gun owners are subject to.
Marijuana is an addictive drug, which produces in its users insanity, criminality, and death.
Marijuana is the most violence-causing drug in the history of mankind.
If the hideous monster Frankenstein came face to face with the monster of marijuana, he would drop dead from fright.
Doctors blame cannabis for rise in National Health Service Viagra spending. Oh, that dastardly cannabis. First you turn us into sex-crazed dope fiends back in the 1930s. Now you shrink our willies and force the government to spend too much money on boner pills.
Doctors blame cannabis for rise in NHS Viagra spending. From the Sunday Mail. Soaring demand is forcing Scotland's health boards to spend £25 million a year on impotence drug Viagra. The number of patients being prescribed the blue pill is climbing by 20% a year in some areas. Experts believe cannabis use could be why more younger men and teens are being treated for impotence. The majority of those taking Viagra are men under 40. But there has been a marked increase in the number of teenage boys being treated for erectile dysfunction. In the last 2 weeks, two experts have linked cannabis use with impotence in young men. Ian Russell, an expert on sexual health at Dumfries and Galloway Royal Infirmary, revealed more Scottish teens than ever before are suffering impotence after smoking cannabis during puberty. And Derek Rutherford, a specialist in sexual medicine for NHS Ayrshire and Erin, said he had prescribed Viagra to cannabis smokers. It is believed so much is being spent in the west of Scotland because traditional health problems, such as heart disease and diabetes, coupled with the high incidence of smoking, all increase the likelihood of impotence. Leading urologist Robin Weber believes men are no longer embarrassed to admit they have problems in the bedroom. She said, quote, "Only a few years ago, it was quite rare for men to come forward and seek help for sexual problems. Now, it is far more common," end quote.
Oh no, it's not that there is wall-to-wall advertising for Viagra. More people have heard of Viagra. More people know they can get Viagra. Men feel pressure to perform and would buy Viagra as an enhancement rather than a treatment. More young people are fatter and eating poorly and playing video games all day. Nope, 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 nope. It's the reefers. Hey, I don't have any problem with men who wish to take a moderately safe drug for recreational purposes. But I think the ratio of young men with medical-grade erectile dysfunction to those who use it to make their sex lives better is about the same ratio as cancer and AIDS patients in state medical marijuana programs to those who use it to make their daily lives better. And no offense, because I think anyone who wants the herb should have it, medical condition or not. Could it be that there are just a lot of people who smoke cannabis and some get ED? And what of the men who report enhanced sex lives from using cannabis? I mean, whoever they may be.
Hello, I'm Paul Stanford from the Hemp and Cannabis Foundation, or THCF. Medical marijuana is legal in 12 states today, and THCF has medical clinics in 6 of those states. Our physicians help qualified patients obtain an authorization for medical marijuana in their state. Patients are eligible for medical marijuana with a history of either severe chronic pain and or nausea, cancer, AIDS or HIV, hepatitis, glaucoma, seizure disorders like epilepsy, chronic muscle spasms as in multiple sclerosis or asthma, neurodegenerative diseases such as Alzheimer's, and gastrointestinal disorders like IBS or Crohn's disease. If you or someone you know has one of these conditions, our doctors will help them obtain a permit for medical marijuana. THCF Medical Clinics has offices in Washington State, Oregon, Colorado, Nevada, Hawaii, and California. Call 1-800-723-0188 or go to the web at www.hemp.org or 1-800-723-0188.
Now it's time to play Pass the Stash, where you can win cool prizes from Normal.
Hey, hey, who found the law?
Okay, for our latest Pass the Stash contest, you could win the uncensored DVD of Totally Baked, written by Craig Shoemaker and autographed by the executive producer Brian Johnson, the lead singer of AC/DC. It's a hilarious story of two medical marijuana activists who hide out in the home of a straight-laced dad and take him and his debate team friends hostage. While the activists employ creative strategies to convince the squares on the truth about cannabis, a Rod Serling-esque narrator, Shoemaker, weaves us through commercials, stand-up, documentary interviews, and skits that are interspersed throughout the movie. All you have to do to win your autographed copy is to send me an email at stash@normal.org. All I want to know is your funniest first-time pot-smoking story. Now, limit your story to 420 words or less and send it in now. This contest only lasts 2 weeks. The winner will be announced May 30th. By submitting a story, you agree to have it published on the Stash blog and read on the air, but we will be glad to change names and identifying details to keep you anonymous. So send in your funny 420 story today and win your autographed free copy of Totally Baked DVD. And thanks for playing Pass the Stash. All right, we're going to go international here on the Daily Audio Stash all the way across the planet to New Zealand. And I'm speaking now with Chris Fowley, who's the spokesperson for Normal in New Zealand. Welcome to the Daily Audio Stash.
Well, kia ora, and thanks for having me on.
You know, Chris, I've been a stoner for a long time, and this is the first time I've ever talked to someone in the future, because it's the next day in New Zealand when I'm talking to you. So how's the future look?
Right. It's tomorrow, that's right.
Well, what I was calling about mostly was we were talking about the Global Marijuana March that took place a couple weekends ago, the first Saturday in May, and you had sent me some great pictures from what you guys call it is J-Day. Why don't you tell us a little bit about what J-Day is like in New Zealand?
Well, we've been organizing J-Day since 1992, and it's got a huge following here. Everyone looks out for it, and we joined it together with the Global March at the beginning of May there, just to make it the same event here for New Zealand. And we have events all over the country, and here in Auckland, we did it in the middle of town in a park. We had a big stage set up and bands playing, and heaps of people came along, and we do a little race called the Growers Ironman. We race contestants around the circuit with bags of fertilizer and buckets of water and things like that. And,
okay.
And, it was a very good day. And I went down to Dunedin, and the Otago Normal in Dunedin have organized an entire week of activities called Cannabis Awareness Week. And things happening every day all through the city and at the university. And we had public debates and movie showings and things like that, and parties and events. And the J-Day down there was just spectacular. They have probably the most cannabis-friendly city in New Zealand. The police have taken a very pragmatic attitude. We haven't had any law change actually happen here, but the police in Dunedin have publicly said that they have much better things to do than harass pot smokers. So, it's very cannabis-tolerant and friendly in Dunedin, and it was a great time.
What kind of turnout did you anticipate or estimate there for the J-Days?
Well, they usually get a few hundred people or a few thousand people even in each city. I mean, it's a fairly small population here in New Zealand, but we do have a very high rate of smoking cannabis. But we also have a very high rate of getting arrested for cannabis, the highest rate in the world, even higher than America.
Really?
And so that puts a lot of paranoia out there, and a lot of people are actually a bit too freaked out and paranoid to come along, which I don't personally understand, because I find the more that more activism, or the more that you put yourself out there and the stauncher you become, and if you know your rights and things like that, the police actually leave you alone even more. You know, they want the easy targets. They want the people who plead guilty in that. They don't want people, activists, who will stir things up and are quite happy to take on court cases. So the police actually never come to the J-Day and never harass people. But it's certainly it was a packed park, and with a hazy smoke hung over the crowd from the time it started to the time the sun went down.
Oh, that's beautiful. Now, what is the state of the cannabis laws there in New Zealand as far as someone getting popped for personal possession? Do they face serious jail time, a fine? What's the range of punishment there?
You wouldn't go to jail for possession. You'd normally get fined, but maybe $100 or $200 would be the fine. But the thing is that you do go to court. You get arrested. You go to court. You get a criminal record. So that's in fact the worst part of it. But in terms of the dealers and the growers, there was a guy just last week who got 6 years for a few hundred plants. So they do get put in jail pretty easily if you're growing. They're quite happy to send people to jail, and the sentences are quite long. And the plant numbers where that kicks in is a lot lower than what you might be used to in North America. Here, I think if they find more than 50 or 100 plants, they're calling it large scale. And I don't think that's quite true in other parts of the world. So yeah, there's still a lot of people in jail for it. But in terms of your average smoker, they don't generally tend to get arrested or fined. And in terms of the law, there's been a lot of talk here over recent years of doing it, but the government's never really followed through. But what they are doing is they've announced a review of the entire drug laws, the Misuse of Drugs Act, they call it here, and they're going to review it from the very founding principles of why do we even have drug laws in the first place? You know, what is the aim of them? Why should we even interfere in people's lives in that way? And then what shape should those laws be, and how will they deal with new drugs that might emerge, or should we have classifications of, you know, A, B, and C, or whatever. So it's a totally thorough review, and that's happening over the course of this year and next year, and I think that's quite exciting because it's not political. They haven't given it to a bunch of politicians who tend to just talk in sound bites and you know, take the populist version of that, and I think that's going to be quite good, that review. So we're really trying to get people involved in that.
Well, that's excellent. And when I'm doing a lot of the news stories here on the podcast, I do try to follow as much of the international news as I can. I do get a lot of stories coming out of Australia, just to the east of you, or to the west of you, excuse me. And it seems to be the politicians down there, at least in Australia, have adopted a lot of the same reefer madness tactics that we see in the UK. What is the general political climate in New Zealand with regard to cannabis reform?
I think we suffer from the same. The politicians, you know, find it easy to score points with those sorts of arguments, and they just ignore the actual evidence and say these same old things. But the Green Party are in Parliament here, and they pursue it pretty strongly. They have good policies. We have, on the other side of the spectrum, we have a party called ACT that represents the far right, and they also support drug legalization. And then we have the Legalized Cannabis Party, who campaign every election. And then, of course, among our ruling party, which is called Labour, who are like the Democrats, most of their politicians have admitted to using cannabis at some point. Most of them, if you ask them privately and quietly, hey, would you support a law, they would say, well, yeah, I probably would vote for that. But in terms of in public, they just don't think there's any votes on it, and so they're not doing a thing about changing the law. And, you know, even our Prime Minister, Helen Clark, she's admitted to using cannabis when she was at university in the 60s. And yet, under her watch, you know, we're getting all these worse laws. We're about to have asset forfeiture laws based on American laws where they won't need convictions and they'll just be able to seize property off people, and then you'll have to take them to court to get your stuff back and prove it's all legitimate. They're bringing in driver drug testing, which we've never had before, and that's going to be based on American laws as well. So, yeah, we haven't been too happy with what's happened under Labor. But, you know, it could get worse, I guess.
Yeah.
Worry, we've got an election coming up, and the other party, you know, are even worse, the other main party.
How much of this new, you're saying that New Zealand is just now getting around to the ideas of drug testing and asset forfeiture. How much of the politics in New Zealand are driven by outside forces, namely United States drug policy?
Well, I don't think they would ever admit that that's what they're doing, but I think they are, you know, that they want to keep in America's good books, and these laws are clearly based on American laws, and, you know, I think there is a lot of that goes on. But on the other hand, New Zealanders as a whole, we tend to pride ourselves on our independence and being a bit different from other people and sort of leading the world. You know, we were the first country to let women have the vote. We were the first country to create, you know, like unemployment benefits and the welfare system and retirement, you know, that kind of thing. So, you know, New Zealand's led the world in a lot of social things. We also have legalized prostitution here. We have civil unions, which is like marriage for gay people. So, you know, there's a lot of things that New Zealand's led the world on, but for some reason, when it comes to drugs, the politicians are just stuck in the same old, you know, tired arguments and cliches that you hear all around the world. And we really are hoping that they can sort of see past that with this review that's going on. And you know, our drug laws, like most of the rest of the world, they date from the 30s or whatever, and they're just outdated. They don't work, you know, hopefully they can see that failure and we can get some proper regulation and legalize cannabis.
Well, let's get people involved in helping you down there in New Zealand. Are there any websites or phone numbers where people could call you for Normal New Zealand and get involved in this fight to end adult marijuana prohibition?
That's right. Yeah, they sure can. Our website is www.normal.org.nz. And that's got links off to other websites as well, and incredibly popular website. We regularly feature in the top 10 most popular here in New Zealand, and have thousands of online members and a huge forum with all sorts of discussions going on. And the number here, if people want to call us up and have a chat about how they can get involved, it's 64 for New Zealand, 9 for Auckland, then 302-5255.
All right, so the website, www.normal.org.nz, like New Zealand. And then the phone number, if you're dialing from the United States and want to just kind of chime in and let you know, let them know how you feel about the interview and what they're doing down down under, so to speak, you'll have to dial the 011 first and then 649-302-5255. Chris Fowley is the spokesperson for Normal New Zealand. Thanks for joining us from the future.
Thanks for having me.
Just say no.
No matter what you call it, it's a huge part of popular culture.
Where'd you learn that, Cheech? Drug school.
You don't need weed school. You just need a copy of the new book, Pot Culture, The A to Z Guide to Stoner Language and Life.
Hey, this is great, man.
Even if you never smoked marijuana.
I never used marijuana. Sorry.
Don't think you smoked marijuana.
I experimented with marijuana a time or two and didn't inhale.
Or you used to smoke marijuana.
I inhaled frequently. That was the point.
Pot Culture by former High Times editor Steve Bloom and Shirley Halperin will answer every question you ever had about marijuana culture.
Has that marijuana made it back up here yet?
Check out Pot Culture, the A to Z guide to stoner language and life at Amazon.com or visit potculturebook.com today.
Too bad, man. I just stopped smoking yesterday.
Here at the Normal Daily Audio Stash, we work hard to change our nation's marijuana laws through education and discussion. But we also take the time to relax and unwind with an eclectic mix of pod-safe music from many independent artists. We look for music that speaks to the growing truth about cannabis, or music that speaks to broader themes of freedom, liberty, social justice, equality, and protest. To find out more about the artists and download the music you hear on this podcast, just log on to stash.normal.org. And if you'd like to get your music heard by the online cannabis community, just send us an email at stash@normal.org. Welcome to Blue Monday, Stashers. Today we get a great blues track from Julian Fouth, with his musical hit, Roll On In, from his well-received second album, Ramblin' Son. Julian Fouth has taken his contemporary blues sound to breathe life into old blues music. He was introduced to the blues at 6 years old when his radio announcer father brought home some old discarded albums. Those old LPs with greats like Muddy Waters and Lightning Hopkins introduced Julian to what has become a lifetime of blues music. Julian's mad piano skills have seen him opening for Buddy Guy and B.B. King and touring around the world, including Cuba, Europe, and the United States. This Toronto blues man is destined to leave his own blues legacy, just like the greats that have come before him. So check out our website at stash.normal.org to get more information on Julian Fouth and a download of this song on MP3. It's Julian Fouth with Roll On In.
Now you may go to church on Sunday and try to do what's right. May make it all the way to Friday, but then come Saturday night. If you want to have a good time, baby, open the door and come on in. Long as you got just a little bit of money, baby, nothing you do tonight is a sin. Well, you could smoke cocaine or reefers, I don't care. You could pop ecstasy. But if you happen to be affiliated with the law in any way, brother, you don't even know me. Or well, you just roll on in, or you won't be alone. You just roll on in, or you won't be alone. Never go home. Well, if you get hungry, get to some of that greasy barbecue. You can make it go down easy with some of that good old two and two. two and two is what we call moonshine. Well, and I tell you why, that stuff will make you too drunk to laugh, brother, and way too high to cry. You could get up and dance on the table, stand up on your head and sing out of key just like me. You can do anything you want, baby, but please leave the guitar player be. You just roll on in, or you won't be alone. You just roll on in, or you won't be alone. Tonight's the night to get high. You may never go home. Don't cut it, there's one on the corner. You won't have to pay her a dime. All you got to do is put in the mood and she'll say, any man that falls on that floor is mine. You just roll on in, or you won't be alone. You just roll on in, or you won't be alone. To get high, you may never go home. Well, and if you're a gambler, follow me and walk this way. You just put your money down on the wood, baby. Go ahead and make it pay. You got to pray, you got to pray to little Saint Joseph. Little boy with the many colored coat, and then you just roll them bones, roll them bones onto your boat. You know they got blackjack and dice, Texas Hold'em, Georgia skin pool and domino. When your money's all gone, baby, go ahead and borrow some more. You just roll on in, or you won't be alone. You just roll on in, or you won't be alone. Tonight's the night to get high. You may never go home. Mm-hmm. You may never go home. You may never go home. You may never go home. You may never, you may never, you may never, you may never.
busted in Laredo, but for reasons that I'd rather not disclose.
I smoke pot, and I like it a lot. Hi, this is Willie Nelson. I learned a long time ago that marijuana is a lot safer to use than alcohol. There's absolutely nothing wrong with the responsible use of marijuana by adults. It's time we stopped arresting and started respecting responsible marijuana smokers in America. And to learn what you can do to help, please contact Normal at www.norml.org or call toll-free at 888-67-NORMAL.
The show was long and we were just sitting there, and we'd come to play and not just for the ride.
We're welcoming back Paul Armentano, the deputy director of Normal, who is now a new father taking care of a beautiful child. Probably not a whole lot of sleep, but we got him on the line anyway. So, Paul, welcome back to the Stash.
Thanks. It's good to be here, Russ.
Now, we were looking at a study that you had brought up. This was a study that took place in Israel at the Hebrew University with regards to marijuana's effect on driving performance. This is kind of a controversial area study, and there's a kind of a paucity of good information about the effects of driving in cannabis. So why don't you give our listeners just a kind of a breakdown of what the study found?
Well, this was actually quite an interesting study because the investigators weren't just looking at the way marijuana can affect driving performance. They actually wanted to compare the way THC impacts driving performance versus the way alcohol impacts driving performance.
Okay.
So what they did was they took 14 volunteers, and these were individuals that had previous experience with both alcohol and marijuana, and they put them in a vehicle that had a fixed-base driving simulator integrated into the car so that these people felt like they were driving on an actual road under actual conditions, but in fact they were not. And what they did was they tested their driving performance when these individuals were sober, and then they later went back and they tested their performance after dosing them with low levels of THC, and they also gave these individuals alcohol. And when they looked at all the data, essentially what they found was that both marijuana and alcohol made individuals differ in their driving performance compared to when they were sober, but that the actual effects of how those drugs influenced their driving performance was very different.
Okay, so the testing for both alcohol and cannabis, what is the difference that we find? I imagine, you know, we can imagine what the alcohol results would be of recklessness or speeding. Do we get a similar result with the THC?
Well, you didn't, actually. And let me actually preface that by saying or talk about some ways in which the performance was, in fact, similar. Under both the influence of marijuana and alcohol, drivers had increased reaction time, meaning that they required more time to react to a situation than they did when they were sober. That was an impairing effect that was noticed under the influence of both substances. Both drivers under the influence of marijuana and alcohol also deviated in their ability to maintain the car in a straight lane, it's what they call standard deviation and lateral positioning. Essentially, it means that they were weaving more when they're under the influence of alcohol or marijuana than they were when they were sober. Those were two similarities that they noticed with both drugs. They also noticed that drivers under the influence of both drugs talked about being more sleepy than they were when they were sober. The major contrast that the investigators found, however, was, as you noted, it was speed control. When individuals were under the influence of marijuana, they tended to drive more slowly. When individuals had taken alcohol, they tend to drive much more fast. The other interesting thing they noted was investigators looked into drivers' subjective feelings under each drug. And what they found was the drivers under the influence of alcohol felt very confident in their driving abilities, which likely led to why they drove more quickly. The individuals who had had marijuana
expressed less confidence in their driving abilities. They felt like they might be impaired, and they tried to compensate for that impairment accordingly by driving more slowly. That was really the major difference that they found in this study, and that pretty much affirms what previous literature looking at this area finds as well. Notably, I will say that when they compared the number of collisions individuals experienced after dosing versus when they were sober, they really didn't find any statistical significance for drivers under the influence of either low amounts of alcohol or THC compared to when they were sober.
Wow, that seems almost counterintuitive. You'd expect it, at least with the alcohol, perhaps maybe more collisions, but I guess that explains why.
Keep in mind, this was a low dose of alcohol.
Oh.
It was not a dose that would have put somebody, for instance, above the 0.08% blood alcohol concentration legal limit in this country. It was an equivalent of alcohol that would put somebody around 0.05.
Oh, okay. Well, that would be a significant difference then. We should definitely point that out. So how does this compare then with other studies, or did they even try to make a link between this data and the possibility of crashes or any of the results of surveys that have shown any sort of fatality or crash increase due to use of THC?
They really didn't go there. They did note, I should note that the investigators essentially defined any change in driving behavior from when the person was sober or when they performed the task and got their baseline as impairment. So, you know, ironically, under the definitions that were used in this study, when cannabis consumers slowed their average rate of speed on the course, that was deemed to be impairment. Others may define that as possibly driving more safely, but that's not the way the investigators chose to interpret that sort of data. So, no, they did not look into policy implications of this data, nor did they look at how this might play out on road, although they did note that we certainly do not see the prevalence of on-road accidents due to the possibility of marijuana use that we see in regards to the use of alcohol. And there's two or three studies, two in particular that were published over the last couple of years, that really do seem to bear that out. There was an analysis of 10 years of crash data in the United States that indicates that a person who's under the influence of marijuana alone may have about a 25 to 30% elevated risk of engaging in a risky driving behavior versus a person who's not under the influence of any substance. But that same study found that an individual under the influence of low levels of alcohol actually had a 100% elevated risk of engaging in dangerous driving behavior. There's also very good data from France from a study that was done about 3 years ago that analyzed fatal crash data. What it found was that individuals who had THC only in their blood had slightly under a twice the risk of sober drivers of having a fatal accident, whereas individuals who had any amount of alcohol in their system actually had 9 times the risk of experiencing a fatal accident compared to sober drivers. So what you see here is, when you look at this on-road data, is a very slight nominal elevated risk of when you analyze drivers who have THC in their system versus drivers who have no drugs in their system, but nowhere near the sort of risk that you see with drivers that have alcohol in their system. There's a very good paper actually from the UK that tries to draw an analogy or sort of some sort of relativism as to what this risk is, and this expert compares the risk of driving after consuming THC to be around the equivalent of the elevated risk a driver who is above the age of 60 experiences compared to a sober driver who is about 30 years of age.
Wow, that's all very interesting, but I wonder how are we going to go forward on this? I know there's a lot of states that are implementing DUID and per se drug driving laws out there. Will this research have any impact on our ways of fighting for these changes in policy that would get rid of these drug driving laws, these per se laws?
Let's hope it does. You know, it's very hard to say, Russ, because the laws that you're speaking of, particularly these zero tolerance per se statutes, they're not based on science to begin with.
Yeah.
So if science and rational policy were to guide this discussion, we wouldn't have these laws already. But we do, and as you noted, some other states are moving in that direction. You know, interestingly, over the last couple of years, there have not been as many states passing these sort of laws as there were 5-6 years ago when several states passed these sort of policies sort of under the radar. California, for instance, has had a debate now for the last couple of years about implementing such a law, but that the bills that have been proposed have really not gone forward, and I think that is in reaction to the fact that there really isn't a whole lot of science of backing these sort of public policies, and that at best the science indicates that very recent use of marijuana may slightly impair certain psychomotor skills, but that impairment is either the equivalent or less than the impairment experienced by individuals who drive after having, say, one or two drinks, but are well below the legal limit for intoxication in this country.
Well, we can only hope that people will learn more about the real science behind this, and we can apply some rational thought to our policies with regard to driving and cannabis out there. Of course, here at Normal, we would never recommend that anyone get behind the wheel if you've recently used cannabis, any more than we'd recommend you get behind the wheel if you just took an antihistamine or were too tired. But we should definitely move forward with facts instead of scaremongering.
Sure. And one thing I'd like to add is that even when some of these impairments are noticed, whether it is needing an increase in reaction time or possibly a deviation or in lateral positioning, these are very short-lived effects. There's a very good Department of Transportation report that came out in 2003 that talks about the acute effects of marijuana on the skills needed to drive a vehicle really only last about 1 hour. In some cases, it might be slightly longer if there was, more potent marijuana. But we're talking about very short-lived effects. And just as somebody would not go drink 3 or 4 beers and immediately get behind the wheel, if someone was to smoke marijuana and simply wait a couple hours before driving, they really would not be putting themselves at any sort of elevated risk. And I think it's really important to point that out. The other quick point I would like to mention when we're talking about some of these analyses of accident data and we're finding these slight elevated risks with marijuana users compared to people that don't have marijuana in their system, one thing that I think is important to talk about is the fact that oftentimes individuals who use marijuana tend to be younger in age, and with that they tend to be less experienced drivers. And it could be that in large part some of this association is not particularly due to the fact of marijuana impairing a person's ability to drive, but the fact that the person driving the vehicle who tends to use marijuana also tends to be a less experienced driver and may simply have an elevated risk of accident because of that.
I think that's a very good point. And another thought that I just had when I heard you talking about that is the idea that people that use marijuana are engaging in illegal activity. Perhaps they're more likely to engage in other risky behaviors.
Interestingly, there is a study that did look at some of that data, and I believe, if I'm remembering it correctly, it found that the individuals who tended to test positive for marijuana also tended to have poorer driving records. They had more speeding tickets, for instance. And while that seemed counterintuitive to me at first, when I thought about sort of the patterns that follow younger drivers,
it seemed to make a lot more sense.
Sure, sure. A function of age. All right. Well, Paul, thanks for joining us here on the Daily Audio Stash with that new study. We'll have links to that up on the Stash blog at stash.normal.org. You can read the results of the study for yourself. Paul Armentano is the deputy director of the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws. And again, thanks for being here.
No problem, Russ.
Thank you for downloading the Normal Daily Audio Stash, the growing truth about cannabis. We are produced by the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws in Washington, D.C. Our executive producer is Alan St. Pierre. Our deputy director is Paul Armentano. Our webmaster is Brian Judy. And web production is provided by Red Aphid Interactive Media. As always, you can catch up on the latest information about marijuana at www.normal.org. And you can interact and download from our Audio Stash blog at stash.normal.org. For everyone here at Normal, I'm your host, Radical Russ Belville, hoping all your harvests are bountiful and your encounters with law enforcement are non-existent. We leave you today with another one of our cannabis quotes, this time from Thomas Jefferson, a former president, founding father, and hemp farmer, who said, quote, "Hemp is of first necessity to the wealth and protection of the country," end quote. Like my friend Madeline Martinez says, it's so true that America's roots are hemp roots. Our American colonies were required by law to grow hemp for textiles, and food, and fuel, and fiber. It's time to re-legalize cannabis in America. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Radical Russ, and until next time, take care of each other, tokers.